This is the Medicast, June 1st, 2009.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up! Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis!
Well, good day and welcome to this episode of the Medicast, episode 170. I want to make sure that all of you who are brand new listeners, and there are quite a few of you out there, are able to find what you need here at the Medicast, and I want to welcome you personally to the community here. Of course, you can find out a lot of information by heading over to Medicast.com. You'll find links there to all the shows we produce, as well as links to the Medicast blog, and there is where you'll find the show notes for each and every episode and other interesting articles, including a whole series this past week on getting ready for national registry testing or any standardized test. There's some good information, some tips on preparing for testing, how to set up a schedule for yourself to do some pre-test preparedness, and also what to do before and the day of the test. So all of that you'll find in a couple of articles, three articles posted this past week over at the Medicast blog. You can go directly there by going to medicast.com/blog. Of course, for all of you longtime listeners, thanks for listening to the show. Thanks for contributing to the community and keeping in touch here with the Medicast by email and voicemail and all the ways you guys keep in touch with me. It's great to hear from you and get all the links and great information that you send in. Of course, you can all send it in to me by email to podmedic@mac.com. You can also call in the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. That's 941-30-MEDIC. One of the emails I got this week was from listener Jacob, and Jacob is getting ready to test on his national registry. He's taken the test twice already and is pretty discouraged and has a test coming up that is, you know, his third time around, and after that he has to go through additional training and remedial follow-up to see what he's missing and try to work on getting his test passed. And so he wants to get it done the third time and was asking about how he could prepare, how he could get in touch with somebody to maybe get together and study with someone else. And it's what prompted me to write that three-part article I put up on the website this past week on just how to prepare and the fact that it's really important to take a lot of practice questions. Many studies are looking at, some of them say 1,000, some of them say 1,500, but that seems to be the cutting point where if you've really practiced with a practice exam and that many practice questions, that seems to be the tipping point that gets you into the group that helped, that is more assuredly able to pass the test. And there's just no, you know, it's more about passing, more about taking a test in this situation than it is about the knowledge. You've gotten through an entire program and passed all the testing in there, so your knowledge is present. But a standardized testing environment is something different, and there are some tricks and some things you can do to help out with that. And one of the things is familiarizing yourself with the structure of the questions and how to look for certain clues that will tip you off on what you're looking for in your answer. And that's just, you know, practice. And so that's a lot of what this article I wrote has to do with. And Jacob kind of led me in that direction. So Jacob, thanks for your email. And please let me know how you do on your testing. And if you have any other questions or anything else we can do to help you out. I also got an email in from listener Greg on some of the new EMS training standards. He and I have been touching base back and forth about QRS complexes, positive deflection in lead 2, and some other things. And he found another answer to his question, and I'm looking over what he sent me. But he also asked a question about what I thought about new standards for the EMTs and paramedics that are coming out from the Department of Transportation, and some of the things that they've updated and some of the way they've changed those standards and the way that they read. And one of the things that he's upset about or concerned about as an instructor is the lack of defined objectives. In other words, an EMT will know this, an EMT will be able to this, and you know, that the objectives are stated clearly as they had been in the past. You know, I think that we need to wait and see how all of this shakes out. I think what they're trying to do is leave it up to individual departments to create a curriculum that meets those standards. And part of that curriculum in most learning institutions is going to be some kind of objective-based studying and objective-based lesson planning. So we'll see how it works out, Greg. I think that I agree with you, at least in part, but we'll have to see what happens and how they arrive at these things. Finally, I got an email in from listener Jerry. He was sending me a link to an article that I heard something about, actually, from my mother-in-law, who's a nurse, and she wanted to know if I'd read about it. I kind of heard the gist of the story from her, but Jerry sent me a link to the article from Australia, and this is a country doctor in a rural part of Victoria in Australia, and what he ended up doing was a 12-year-old boy had had a bike accident, developed a blood clot on his brain, and in this location, they didn't have the resources to treat him effectively or get him to the type of help he needed, and he was tanking fast, you know, going downhill. So what did he do? Well, he used the tools he had at hand to get the job done. He got a household drill, power drill, and used that to drill through the boy's skull and drain the blood clot. This is, of course, some people are shocked, other people are amazed, but I think that the comments from a neurosurgeon who was asked to comment on this particular story, a leading neurosurgeon was quoted as saying, quote, one of the gutsiest life-saving efforts imaginable, end quote. And I think that I wonder if this doc used to be a paramedic at some point in his career, because, you know, this is the kind of things that EMTs, paramedics, and EMS providers, first responders of all kinds, working in the field, have to make do with the resources we have on hand. We only have what we carry on our units, and we have to be able to multitask with some of these things. We use pillows as splints. We double up blankets and use them as padding. We do all kinds of things with different tools to get the job done. You know, I've made eye flushes using normal saline dripping through an IV set. You know, it's just the kind of thing you need to do. I know somebody that actually set up a nasal cannula for somebody who had gotten an exposure in both his eyes, set up a nasal cannula to drip, hooked up to an IV fluid, drip across the bridge of the nose into the eyes to continuously flush the eyes en route to the hospital using saline. And these are the kind of things that, you know, there's a tool that does that, but we don't have room to carry every single specialized tool. And you know what? A nasal cannula will do the job just as well for that kind of thing. And kudos to that kind of thinking ahead. So I think this is a great story. And it just points out to us that for all of the high-tech stuff that we have access to in some of our services, for all of the things we see that hospitals can and can't do, you know, it still comes down to good assessment, good exam skills, and thinking on your feet and using the tools you have at hand to do the job. And so I say kudos to this doctor. Obviously, he got the job done and figured it out. But I think that it just points out to us that there are always going to be different ways we can approach our problems and challenges in the field, and to make sure that we're open-minded enough to think outside the box and think about tools in different ways. Of course, a drill is a drill is a drill, and before they had the high-tech drills they have in operating rooms, they were using basic hand drills just like everybody else was using in woodworking. And you know what? I think I'm going to throw that out there as the link of the week this week. It is a great story, and I will just leave it at that and let you all follow up in the show notes. Those of you that, of course, get the newsletter will get the link of the week and all the other links sent to you by email. So if you don't already get that, you might want to sign up for the newsletter. But you can also find that in the show notes under the podcast, the EMT podcast category in the blog, and the show notes for this and every other episode are there. And the link of the week for this week will be that particular article about the power drill saving this boy's life. I'll jump into the news this week with a first item that I found was kind of amusing, and I thought it might be something that you would be interested in as well. Of course, I guess that's how I put all these stories together. But there's a Florida emergency department in Panama City that is putting together a program where they will be putting their hospital average ER wait times on the website, and you can actually get them texted to you. So you could sign up to get text messaging, and you will be able to find out what the ER wait times are for you on a regular basis. This is pretty interesting, actually, I wonder if the responders are using it. The article I found over at emsresponder.com actually talks about that this is going to be targeted to the public so that they can realize that they're not going to go to the ER for something serious if they have to wait for a long time and know that. And maybe it'll alleviate some of the overcrowding. Of course, I would wonder, you know, if you have an ER that's really slow that day, you know, don't use the S word, right, or the Q word. But if you're really not having a huge patient population in your emergency department, and you put it out there as a text message, you know, 5-minute wait time to get seen, and you know, suddenly you wonder why an hour later you've got your pack to the gills because everybody saw that and decided it was a great time to come in and get seen for their toothache or their hangnail or whatever. So I wonder how this is going to work for them, but it's certainly an interesting thing. And as a responder, I think it might be nice to know what the wait time is. Maybe you can talk to people on the scene and let them know, you know, even if you go in by ambulance, you're going to have a wait time. I just got their text message that says they've got a 2-hour wait time to be seen. And you're not in a critical condition that I can tell. So you might want to consider whether you can wait and see your primary care. Maybe you're not allowed to do that. I don't know. Obviously, we want to make sure people get seen if they need to be seen, but we may be able to utilize this in some new and interesting ways if we make our public aware of it, maybe they can make better decisions about getting to the emergency department and tying up resources there. It's an interesting article, and of course, there's a link to this in the show notes. I wonder if anyone near you is doing something similar about posting wait times for their hospitals. Next up is a story I picked up out of the UK. It's at telegraph.co.uk, and it's about stroke patients that were facing some delays based on an ambulance computer error. This has to do with cases where people there were accessing 999, which is their emergency service, like 911, for calls. And they use a medical dispatch software to dispatch things based on when people call in and answer a series of questions. And it's supposed to help the call staff, who don't have a lot of medical training necessarily, assess what the patient needs and what kind of services they can be sent to them, whether it's an ambulance or just a fast response unit, whatever. Stroke patients, however, are only categorized and as emergency patients if they are unconscious and if an ambulance can reach them in a certain period of time. Otherwise, they get sent a lesser priority unit. And this is interesting, only if they're unconscious. So what about other stroke patients? We all know that time is brain cells, just like we can talk about cardiac and heart attack patients as time is muscle. If the more time, even if the stroke is recent onset or the patient is still conscious, the more time that they have this ongoing problem, the longer it is to get treatment and more likely that they will not have a full recovery. We know that if we can get this person into thrombolytics, if they're having a clot-based stroke instead of a hemorrhagic stroke, if they have a stroke based on a blood clot, there can be treatment that can get them near a full recovery and vastly improve their level of disability, even if they don't have a full recovery. And this, of course, it saves money, saves time, saves resources all the way down the road for a patient if we can get to them quicker. So I'm not quite sure why this is, and that's one of the questions in this particular article. Researchers found that the software really had a glitch in it and that they were needing to change the way that they assessed stroke patients using this call-taking system because it was not correctly categorizing strokes in the way that they needed to. So we'll have to see how this shakes out. Obviously, this is something that is affecting people in the UK. It may not be something affecting other parts of the world, but it calls to mind that we really need to continue to improve the way we think about strokes and really put it in the same category as serious cardiac illnesses and injuries, because we need to get those patients rapid treatment and assessment as well. So we'll see how this shakes out, but it's something to keep in mind. And it just, I think, raises awareness, if nothing else. Next up is kind of an alarming story I found, having to do, it's coming out of Hawaii, it's the Honolulu Advertiser, talking about a phone scam that police had identified there, where callers were talking to residents and getting them to purchase a special medical identification card for use by paramedics when they arrived, and kind of giving them the impression, or maybe out and out saying, that this was an official document that they needed to get if they required paramedic services to accurately identify them and to know their treatments and history ahead of time. And, you know, this is something that is a problem when you think about how vulnerable some of our populations are, especially the elderly populations. This is something that the paramedics in that region are alarmed about. I think it's something we're should be alarmed about if it's something like that crops up in our region. But it again points out to me that many of the public whom we serve are people who don't really understand what we do, who don't have a way to touch base with us or a relationship with us where they can contact us and know how things work and what's going on. You know, how open are we about talking about things like this? We should let people know the ways, you know, officially, the ways we'd like them to keep their information handy, whether it's, you know, putting a form on your website or having something mailed out to all of your residents or distributed by hand at public events or to local senior centers, senior housing facilities. You can hand out a form that's very easy to fill out that has a list of their medications on it, that has all that stuff that they can just keep and put on their fridge with a magnet. There's lots of different programs out there. People keep them in medicine containers, in the fridge, whatever. You know, it's something they can just have and hand to you when you come to the door, and that it's free. Something they can download from a website, something they can print out, something they can have you drop by and give to them. And again, public education of what we do and how we do it is the key part of how this works. Finally, you know, it seems like they've got a week for everything. All kinds of different organizations and causes and, you know, awareness weeks for different professions. We just had EMS week. This past week was Hurricane Preparedness Week. So we've had actually 2 weeks cropped up on my radar recently. Hurricane Preparedness Week from the National Weather Service here in the U.S., teaching us to be prepared and learn about hurricane awareness from the different resources that are available out there. And I found this article over at emsresponder.com, but it's just knowing what your particular region's vulnerabilities are, how you should prepare to take care of yourself during a hurricane and a disaster, actions you should take. And this Hurricane Preparedness Week is to get us ready because hurricane season kicks off June 1st, today. So it's something that we all need to think about for whatever our region is. What are the natural disasters for which we need to be prepared, whether it's hurricanes, tornadoes, blizzards, earthquakes, landslides, brush fires, whatever it might be. Again, it comes into public education. We won't have to work as hard if we have a well-educated and prepared public, because they will know what to expect from us and we'll know what to expect from them. And because of that, we won't have anything slipping through the cracks, people that didn't do what they were supposed to do and get trapped, which thereby puts them in danger and consequently puts us in danger. So these are things to be aware of. And so I'd urge you to, even though Hurricane Preparedness Week happened this past week, something to check in and look at your own area's disaster planning and how it would affect you and your family, not just you as the responder, but you as the person who lives in your region. Also, the second annual National CPR and AED Awareness Week coming up this week, June 1st through the 7th, is being put on by the American Heart Association and the American Red Cross to teach people and help them understand the importance of bystander CPR, the importance of how well an AED can prepare the public to save a life before we ever get there. All of these things are important goals and, again, come down to public education. There are a lot of resources for this. All of the AED manufacturers have resources on their sites. I actually have a link here to a site from Philips.com, they're a maker of an AED and makers of defibrillators. You can find these kinds of materials all over the place. And if you contact them, they may be able to provide you some public awareness materials that you can leave around your area to help educate people about AEDs and for their facilities, whether it's a church or a civic organization, a town hall, a local establishment that might have a lot of people in it, like a supermarket. All of these places are prime locations to have an AED and some people who are trained to do CPR and to use it properly. And again, comes down, just like disaster planning saves us extra work and hassle, so does a presence of a CPR-trained individual and an AED. Because if that person has a returned spontaneous heartbeat when we get there, we don't have to do CPR, and we will have to treat them and take them to the hospital, but we will have had a patient who's going to be more likely to live and get back out of the hospital at the other end, and it's going to be less work for us in the long run. So I urge you to take a look at these two particular articles, and there'll be a link in the show notes to both of them. Time now for this week's tip and trick of the week, and we're going to invite a good friend of ours back here to share some information with us. Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center will be joining us again here just shortly to share with us some information that she and I recorded earlier about a problem that you may not have heard about, and it's actually something that if you've heard about it, you may not understand exactly what it is, and that's fish poisoning. Ciguatera fish poisoning is not what you think it is, and it's something that you may run into, especially as people are going out of doors or maybe going on vacation, trying out some fish dishes in a restaurant somewhere, and may come back with some unusual signs and symptoms that you may equate with a neurological problem, you may equate with a stroke perhaps, and you'll be scratching your head if you get an ambulance call to go see this patient, and you'll take them into the hospital. And it just underlines, as we look at what Elisa explains to us here, is the importance of taking a good sample history, getting the signs and symptoms together. They may not make sense to you, but if you start getting a good history to this patient, you can relay some things to the emergency department to help point them in the right direction. It may be one little thing you say because you ask the right question that gives the nurses and the doctors in the emergency department the clues they need to take the right test and look for the right thing. And yeah, they're supposed to ask those questions too, but we're part of a team approach here. And so you may even be in their home and notice that they traveled recently because there's luggage there sitting out because they just got back the day before. Again, these are questions that you can learn to ask. Oh, have you traveled recently? There are a lot of problems associated with people traveling to different locations, and just pointing out that they've been on a trip recently can point to things, not just fish poisoning, but problems like DVT, pulmonary embolism. All of these things can come about from people who've traveled recently because of the formation of blood clots. So those are just problems that you can run into. So without further ado, let's go into this recorded segment that I had the opportunity to talk with Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the PodMedic. It's time again for another visit with our good friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center and her talks tidbit for us. Lisa, how you doing?
Fine, thanks, Jamie.
So I heard you say you're going to be talking about fish poisonings this month. I really am interested to hear what that's all about.
Right, fish poisoning. And I think when you hear the term fish poisoning, you might think of fish that isn't prepared properly, or old fish, or something that causes food poisoning, but that's not really the case here. These are two different types of poisonings that occur with fish under different circumstances, so I'd just like to talk about those for a few minutes. So imagine you're evaluating a young woman, or a young man, doesn't matter, who's complaining of nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and weakness, but is also complaining of some very unusual symptoms. He or she is complaining of some sudden tooth pain, feels like their teeth are falling out, has numbness of the mouth, and a very strange burning feeling in the hands and feet, especially when he or she touches something cold. very kind of odd signs and symptoms here. There's no past medical history that would help to diagnose her problem. So upon further questioning, you find out that she ate grouper at a seafood restaurant a few hours ago. So could this be the cause of her symptoms? Well, the answer is yes. This patient is suffering from something called ciguatera fish poisoning. Ciguatera fish poisoning occurs when fish is eaten that contains toxins produced by an organism that grows on algae in tropical waters. This toxin accumulates in small fish that feed on the algae. Then, in turn, these small fish are the major food source for larger fish. So the large fish eat the small fish, and the toxin becomes more concentrated in the larger fish, mainly in pretty much everywhere in the fish, but mainly in the fatty tissue of the fish, the flesh of the fish, and the viscera of the larger fish. So the fish most commonly involved in these poisonings include barracuda, red snapper, amberjack, grouper, surgeon fish, sea bass, parrotfish, sturgeon, and dolphin, and there are many other fish that can be involved as well. In the United States, poisonings occur most frequently in warm water areas, so around Hawaii, Florida, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and other tropical territories. However, fish do migrate sometimes, and they have migrated as far as South Carolina and Texas, where cases have been reported. Scientists theorize that with increasing water temperatures and changes in the fish migration patterns, the presence of this organism will maybe increase in the Gulf of Mexico and southern Atlantic coastline and work its way up the coast. Now, the cases that we hear about in Maryland and that we hear about in other more northern states usually involve people that have just returned from visits to areas where poisonings are more common, so the more tropical or warm areas. But also fish that have been shipped from southern waters to other areas have also resulted in poisonings. It's nearly impossible to detect the presence of the toxin. The appearance, the taste, and the smell of the contaminated fish are not altered, and the toxin is not destroyed by cooking or freezing. And it has nothing to do, really, with how the fish is prepared or how it's been stored or refrigerated prior to being prepared in the restaurant. The onset of clinical effects is usually within 2 to 6 hours, but it can be delayed for as long as about 30 hours after eating the contaminated fish. Numbness and pain of the mouth, the tongue, and the extremities, as well as some GI symptoms like abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, and very profuse watery diarrhea are characteristic of the ciguatera fish poisoning. Now, these GI symptoms might lead you to believe that there's a food poisoning going on here, but patients also exhibit these other more unusual symptoms that might clue you into the fact that it's due to the fish. Other effects that they might complain about are muscle weakness, sweating, itching, headache, watery eyes, blurred vision, a metallic taste, and chills. Now, the sensation of burning when hands and feet are in contact with cold objects has been described, and it's actually been described as a cold-hot temperature reversal. It's not really what happens, but that's how it's often described. Bradycardia, hypotension, hypothermia, and respiratory depression can also develop in severe cases. It's rare, but it can happen, and those more severe symptoms are usually delayed for 1 to 3 days. Fatalities are very rare, fortunately. Gastrointestinal symptoms usually subside within about 24 to 48 hours or so, but the neurologic and cardiovascular symptoms can persist for days or weeks, and in some cases even for months. And oddly enough, the neurologic symptoms can be worsened by stress, by drinking alcohol, or vigorous exercise. So if a patient does have ciguatera fish poisoning, they should be instructed to avoid all of those for several months afterwards. Treatment consists of supportive care. Activated charcoal can be beneficial in a case where the patient presents very early after the ingestion, but that really never happens. Most patients don't realize that they've eaten contaminated fish until many hours later when symptoms develop. The CDC and the FDA are very interested in gathering data on cases because they want to get a better picture of the incidence of the ciguatera fish poisoning. They feel that a lot of the cases are going unreported and that potentially the number of cases will increase as environmental factors change. So it's recommended that all cases or all possible cases be reported to your local poison center and then ultimately the FDA. The FDA will actually analyze the fish for the toxin at no cost. So just as a reminder, the local poison center can be reached by calling 1-800-222-1222. Now, there's another type of fish poisoning that's called scombroid or histamine fish poisoning. And that occurs when fish are eaten that haven't been properly refrigerated at any point in time between when they're caught and when they're prepared to be eaten. The fish spoil and bacteria on the spoiled fish produce histamine and other substances that aren't destroyed by cooking. Outbreaks in the United States have occurred after eating fish such as mahi-mahi, tuna, and bluefish, but there are other species that can be involved. Some people describe the spoiled fish as having a peppery taste, but not always. Symptoms usually begin within 5 minutes to 2 hours after eating the fish, and the symptoms include such things as flushing, itching, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and rarely bronchospasm. So they sound and look very much like an allergic reaction. Symptoms usually resolve on their own within 12 to 36 hours, but you can give antihistamines such as Benadryl or diphenhydramine, and they can ease the symptoms much more quickly. In rare cases of severe symptoms, steroids and epinephrine can be given. Now, it's important to remember also that since this is not a true allergic reaction to the fish itself, eating the same species that has been refrigerated properly in the future is safe in someone who's had a past reaction. So I just wanted to make your listeners aware of these fish poisonings because a lot of healthcare providers really aren't familiar with these, and we are seeing what we think is possibly an increase in the incidence of these poisonings.
Well, thank you, Lisa. I'll have to think about that the next time I order fish.
Right. Not all fish, but certain fish.
I know.
And unfortunately, it's difficult. You know, again, you can't look at the fish or taste it or there's no way of really knowing that fish has been contaminated. So it's a little scary in that respect, but it's not terribly common, but just something to think about.
Okay, Lisa. Well, thanks a lot. We'll look forward to hearing from you again next month.
Thanks, Jamie.
I'd like to thank Lisa Booz again for joining us and taking the time to really get this information out to us. The variety of topics that she comes up with in the segments that she's done for us over the last year, year and a half or so, have been really valuable in looking at the many different ways that we can use and utilize poison centers and the information they can provide for us to help treat our patients, and to point out to us that many times the poison center can provide information for our patients that will allow us to not have to take them to the hospital because of high quality information from the poison centers working in conjunction with our hospital physicians and online medical control. So I just want to thank Lisa again. You can find more information about the things she talks about and sign up for her Talks Tidbits email newsletter over at Maryland Poison Center's website, mdpoison.com, and you'll find links to the newsletter and information over there. And you don't have to be from Maryland to get access to that, so I urge you to take advantage of the resources that Lisa makes available for us. And you know what? That's going to wrap up this week's episode of the MedicCast. I want to again thank Lisa. I want to thank all of you. Thank the listeners that sent in their emails. And just everybody out there for being such a great member of the MedicCast community. As we roll into wrapping up the first half of 2009 this month, I want to thank all of you for continuing to contribute and support the MedicCast. Share the MedicCast with somebody you know this week. Get out there and maybe leave a review of the recent episodes that you've enjoyed the most over at your favorite EMS forum, or tell a friend or your partner about it and let them listen to it. All kinds of ways you can do that. If you sign up for the newsletter, you can just forward the newsletter to somebody that you think might be interested, an instructor, a training officer, whatever. It's a great way to share and support the MedicCast. And I just want to thank all of you for helping out with that. Of course, you can continue to keep in touch with me. Send those emails into podmedic@mac.com. You can also, of course, call into the voicemail line, 941-306-3342. 941-30-MEDIC is your way to leave a voicemail message. Don't forget to leave your first name and also at the very end, your email address. I will cut it off so it doesn't go out over the show if I share it with the rest of the listeners, but it is a way for me to get back in touch with you if I need some clarification or wanted to ask you some more information about what you were asking. So let's keep that information coming in and keep sharing what you have to say with the other listeners here at the MedicCast. That's going to wrap things up for me. I'll close out the show, as I always do, with some PodSafe Music from the PodSafe Music Network. And this particular artist is a new one here for the Medicast. His name's Michael Heaton, and he is an artist who has some pretty clever music and interesting to listen to. This is his song, I Know What I Know. You'll find a link in the show notes to both his personal website, and you'll also find a link to purchase his song over at iTunes if you'd like to do so. And I urge you to check out the music, support these artists who make their songs available to you free of charge here on the podcast to listen to and hear some great new music. And it's a great opportunity for you to be able to do that. So if you like what you hear, pick up their song, spend 99 cents and support these artists. And if you go to their website, let them know you heard it here on the Medicast. So without further ado, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I want to remind all of you to make sure you remember scene safety and BSI.
We moved out in the dark night. I started my life in between the lines. Still black and it's never white. It's sometimes wrong, it's sometimes right. Even the shades of gray are dark and light. I know what I know. Well, I've seen things I ain't supposed to. It's fires I've been way too close to. Lost my my scars right here on this broken heart. People just don't always tell the truth. I know what I know. Box.